When you build a class specifically designed to be accessible for the people who have the hardest time with this information, you're not favoring those students at the expense of students who have an easier time learning. Peter Michael took an exercise that dads do with their four-year-olds and put it in a classroom in one of the most reputable institutions for engineering in the country, in the world. And that class loved it. More accessible resources aren't just better for the people who absolutely need them. When we design for the folks who have the hardest time accessing something, we tend to make it more accessible for everyone, including the people who would have had access to it the standard way. When we're specifically designing something for somebody who has the most trouble accessing it, it tends to get better for almost everyone. I really believe that. I think about that every time I teach. And I believe that if everybody who taught thought about that more, we would have better educational resources for everything. That's my soapbox.
Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast bringing you the making of stories of successful software developers to help you on your upcoming journey. I'm your host, Tim Bourguignon. On this episode, I receive Chelsea Troy. Chelsea is a staff data engineer at Mozilla, focused on the role of data privacy and scientific rigor in automation. She's a maintainer for the ROC programming language and mentors formerly incarcerated technologists through Emergent Works. She also teaches Python and mobile development at the University of Chicago, hosts workshops for Riley, and writes at chelseatroy.com. Oh, and she flings barbells around for fun. For fun. And she drives an e-bike named Gigi, because why not? Chelsea, I hope we'll hear about this. Welcome to Dev Journey.
Sure.
But before we come to your story, I want to thank the terrific listeners who support the show every month. You are keeping the Dev Journey lights up. If you would like to join this fine crew and help me spend more time on finding phenomenal guests than editing audio tracks, please go to our website, devjourney.info, and click on the Support Me on Patreon button. Even the smallest contributions are giant steps toward a sustainable Dev Journey journey. Thank you. And now, back to today's guest. As you know, the show exists to help the listeners understand what your story looked like and imagine how to shape their own future. So, as is usual on the show, let's go back to your beginnings. Where would you place the start of your dev journey?
Let's see. So I would start my dev journey. I was in an undergraduate classroom. This doesn't go the way a lot of stories start in undergraduate classrooms, but I was in this like 60-person introduction to computer science lecture hall. And this guy gets on stage. His name was Peter Michael Ocera. And I'm pretty sure Peter Michael Ocera does not remember who I am and would not know me from Adam if I were to reach out to him now. In fact, I think I did reach out to him a couple years ago and tell him what I was doing now. But so he gets on stage and he's got no slides at the beginning of class. He's got no PowerPoint or anything like that. He looks out at all of us. He introduces himself. He says he is going to introduce us to the idea of how computers work. And the way that he's going to do this is he is going to play act as a computer. And we are going to tell him what to do. And then he rolls out this food grade kitchen table on stage, and it's got a bunch of bread and peanut butter and jelly. And he says, I want you to tell me how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I need the instructions for how to make you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I'm going to make you a sandwich, but I need you to explain to me how to do it. And so people start kind of tentatively raising their hands. And somebody says, well, first you got to get the bread. So he grabs the bread and is like, get two slices or something like that. And he says, you know, I can't get to the two slices, and takes his hand and like pokes it into the bag, which is not open. And so this proceeds about the way you would imagine. Different people are giving different instructions. And you may have seen like these TikTok videos or Instagram videos where dads like do this to their four-year-old children. And the next thing you know, the peanut butter is all over somebody's face and the knife is in the jelly. And that's exactly how it went. Just exactly.
That's exactly we spent what I'm probably, thinking about.
It was excellent. We spent 25 or 30 minutes on this. And I remember at the time being like, this is how you start a computer science course, because this was not a guy talking to 4-year-olds. He was teaching 60 undergraduates at like a relatively reputable institution. And he was still using this peanut butter and jelly method. And it hooked me on the class. And all of his pedagogy was like this. The class was absolutely excellent. I loved it. After I came out of that class, I was like, I want to be a programmer. And we're going to come back to that because my story takes a big winding loop. But I do want folks to remember Peter Michael O'Sara because it does come back to him. I did not get his permission to talk about him in such glowing terms on this podcast, but I hope he's okay with it. That's his real name. Sorry, Peter. But so then I want to do this. So I go on to the next class in the series. I got an A in Peter Michael O'Sara's class. I earned the A. It wasn't just that he liked me. He doesn't know who I am. I will repeat. I get to the second class, and I won't say the name of this instructor. It was a very different experience. It was a lot of PowerPoints. It was an immense amount of, this was a 120 person lecture, I believe. It was an immense amount of all of us staring at her while she tried to debug a thing that wasn't working. And then as the final bell rang and we all left, she was like, well, you get the idea for how it's supposed to work. And then I went to her, I was having a lot of trouble in the class. And I went to her office hours and talked to her about what I could do and why I was having so much trouble. Because when I had been in high school and college and everything, office hours had always been a cure-all for me. Like if I went to office hours, I was able to get the help that I needed. And it had just always been a no-brainer for me. Oh, if you're having trouble, don't give up. Go to office hours. And that was what had been drilled into. I went to a high school that, you know, I was very privileged to go to a high school where the teachers felt that way and where the teachers stood behind that. And so now I'm in undergrad and I go to these office hours. And in these office hours are where this instructor informs me, and this is more or less a direct quote, maybe I just lack the intellectual firepower required for a profession like this. And that wording, intellectual firepower, has stuck with me forever because I make fun of her for it when I'm like on stage talking and stuff like that. But at the time, it really hit me very hard and I quit. I did not further pursue computer science in my undergraduate education. It took me a very long time to come back to it. I pursued international relations. I was training to be a spy. I didn't understand at the time all of the ethical and political implications of being a spy. I learned Arabic. I learned counterintelligence. I learned counterinsurgency. You know, very easy topics that I had the intellectual firepower for. Unlike computer science 2 or whatever the class was. And so then I graduated. I graduated into a recession. There was a government shutdown. None of the intelligence community in the United States was hiring. So I was mercifully saved from being in a career that I probably would have found out a couple years later was completely against everything that I stood for ethically and personally. And I did other odd jobs in the meantime. I was a blogger for an equity crowdfunding startup before equity crowdfunding was completely legal in the United States. I edited a quack psychology magazine. I worked as a rowing coach. I worked as a stand-up comedian. I ended up getting an internship that was sort of adjacent to the field that I had studied in undergraduate. My job was to do open source intelligence gathering, which is a fancy word that we use for look at images from Google Maps to figure out who has a lot of airplanes and look at images taken on publicly available like customs websites and read the Farsi on the bags to determine what's in the bags. I didn't speak Farsi, but I could read Arabic lettering because I knew Arabic and I knew enough French from having grown up in Louisiana. Between the Arabic and the French, I still didn't know Farsi, but I could figure out what a bag said in Farsi usually. it was interesting, paid terribly. and eventually realized like what I miss what I experienced in Peter Michael Lucera's class. I really enjoyed that. And transparently, I wanted some job security because I was doing all these weird jobs. And it looked to me like if you could write code, usually somebody wanted to hire you. So I reached out to the CTO of the equity crowdfunding startup, which I had long since moved on from. It turns out that if your main line of business stays illegal for long enough, you have to lay everybody off, which is what had happened to me. But I reached back out to him and I was like, hey, do you have any recommendations if like a person wanted to get started in coding? He introduced me to his friend, Jay Wengrow, who at the time was starting a coding bootcamp. This was a long time ago at this point, folks. It feels like, at the time the bootcamp was called Anyone Can Learn to Code. And I was like, you know, I can't quit making income and pay $17,000 for a bootcamp. This is what people were doing with Dev Bootcamp at the time. And I just couldn't do it. Jay was starting a night and weekend thing that somebody could still do around a day job. So I talked to Jay a little bit. Jay and I did some tutoring together. He taught me a few things about Ruby on Rails and it was a lot of fun. And it reminded me of all of the things that I had really enjoyed about Peter Michael Lucera's class. And I asked him like, what would it take to do this bootcamp scenario? And he explained to me the night and weekend idea. And we talked about whether it would be a good fit for me and decided it would be a good fit. What I was going to do is I was going to come to Chicago. I was going to do the bootcamp. I was going to help because I had a little bit of a head start from the tutoring. I would help sort of TA my group through. And that was going to help on the tuition side for me. And once we decided that was indeed what I was going to do, he was like, all right, the only catch is, I was living in DC at the time doing this look for airplanes on Google Maps job. And he said, I need you to be in Chicago in 10 days. I was like, okay. I mean, it's quick. Luckily at the time I didn't have a lot of stuff. So I packed all my bags. I came to Chicago. It was summer. I came in June. And everyone had told me, oh, you know, the Chicago winter is terrible. You're going to die out here, blah, blah, blah. So I was terrified and I figured, well, I'm going to take the summer. I'm going to learn to code over the summer. And then I'm going to get a job somewhere with a more temperate climate and I'm going to leave. And I did my immersion program. And that immersion program is now, by the way, if folks are looking for it online, it's not called Anyone Can Learn to Code anymore. They decided they needed a name that sounded more Harvard-y. And so they chose Actualize. So now if you're looking for it, the program is called Actualize. I believe the logo is now a sort of like mountain looking thing. It used to be a penguin. Jay is fantastic. Jay gave me my start in programming. Jay gave me the best piece of advice that I received as a software engineer, which I will tell you later. However, Jay, if you're listening, the logo used to be a penguin and that was better. I liked the penguin. Tim's like, who, why did I get this person? No,
I'm laughing my ass off. That's good.
So anyway, I do my immersion program and I graduate. And I will come back to that piece of advice that Jay gave me. But I got a job offer at Pivotal Labs, which was just starting its office in Chicago. That job offer was given to me by Austin Vance, who I think made a mistake.
Why?
We can get to that. but yeah, so that kept me in Chicago. And now I've been here 9 years. I don't work at Pivotal Labs anymore, but I worked there for a while. It got me my start in programming. I said I would come back to a few things. Peter Michael Lucera, I'm still going to come back to. But first, Jay. Jay gave me the best piece of advice that I received for my career, which was consider starting a blog. Now, here's what I'm going to say, is that was not advice personalized for me. I think Jay was giving that advice more or less to all students at the time. For me personally, that piece of advice worked out really, really well. I started that blog in June of 2014. That blog's going to hit its 9th anniversary in June of this year. There's something like 420 posts on that blog. And I have said in a number of public fora that when that blog hits 1,000 posts, I will retire. No one believes me. Everybody thinks I'm joking. I maintain that I'm not. That's going to be my metric from when I quit this career. But the nice thing about the blog for me has been that the reasons that I have kept the blog have changed over time, but there's always been a reason that's kept me in it. At first, when I first started learning, that blog was a way for me to record what I was learning, because I found that if I had the opportunity to try to teach it to somebody else, that helped me retain the information much better. And I think supercharged the immersion program for me in a way that doesn't always happen for folks, because I was effectively TAing my cohort, which meant everything that everybody else was allowed to be a beginner on, I had to be able to teach somebody else right away. And that meant, it meant a lot of studying. It meant a lot of time commitment. I think probably if I had dependents, if I had children, if I had like a really demanding full-time job at the time, it would have been very difficult. So I came from a place of a lot of privilege that I had the opportunity to work as hard as I did in that immersion program, and also in my first few months at Pivotal Labs, which we will get to. But in the beginning, I was using the blog to learn. Then eventually I was using the blog to record. When I got into my job, I would find occasionally there were things that were very poorly documented online. I needed to learn how to do a card flip animation in Android at one point for a project that I was working on. And at the time, the documentation for how to do that was not good. The documentation for how to do that was not good. I was doing generally mobile development at the time, and documentation for how to do test-driven anything in any mobile framework, but particularly iOS, was not good. And so I found that if I learned to do something that was poorly documented and I wrote a blog post about it, people would use it. And so it gave me an opportunity to add to the programming conversation in a way that my early posts, like how to write BizBuzz or whatever, that wasn't adding to the conversation. Those were for me. This was where I started to write posts that had an audience that wasn't just me. And it was fine. And I want people to understand this. If you have a blog and the audience is you and you're enjoying it, that is fine. That is enough. You are enough of an audience to make a project. It does not have to be for somebody. Nobody else has to like it. If you're getting something from it, that's all that matters. And maybe it'll be for somebody later, like my blog was, or maybe it won't. That's okay. You're enough of an audience.
Have you had the experience of writing something for somebody else and years down the line, Googling it and finding your own blog post and saying, what? I wrote about this. I completely forgot about that. And you have your own answer as documentation of what you should do now.
Yes, that has happened to me. So there is a blog post that I wrote called, "If I Had a Quarter for Every Time I Received This Damn Dagger Error." I have Googled that title specifically, knowing that I would be the best person to ask about that. But I have also had the experience where I Googled it and been like, oh my gosh, I wrote about this and I'm going to help myself get out of this rut. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a wonderful experience. I've also had the experience of somebody one time arguing with me about how to test drive something in Android. And I was of one position and they were of another position. And they were like, no, you're wrong. I'm right. I can find someone who can back me up. And so they go look up a blog post online. And I was like, Rob, what's the name on the top of that blog? Rob, what is my name? Rob.
Point in case. This is awesome. Indeed, blogging is really a superpower. If you allow me, I want to pick at just one word you say. When you gave the advice at the beginning, you didn't say start a blog. You say consider starting a blog. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference?
I would say so. I think the difference is that writing is a medium that works well for me. I have a relatively easy time expressing in words what comes out of my brain. And so for me, writing was a really great way to leverage a skill set I already had to help me build this other skill set, which was first programming and then software engineering. And then sort of the whole variety of skill sets around that. It helped me with data science. It helped me with sort of managerial and organizational tasks and those kinds of things. And I was able to access all of those through the skill that I had, which was writing. Writing does not come easily to everyone. And writing is not the medium that everybody finds the most enjoyable for figuring out how to learn. And so I think a blog is a way to access what I accessed. I think starting a project that you're excited about might also be a way to access what you access. My students, so I teach at the University of Chicago now, and I encourage students to do final projects about topics they're interested in. And I've seen apps about Pokemon and apps about mushrooms and all kinds of things. Chicago tends to be a pretty civically engaged town. And so I've seen a lot of students do, like, I used Chicago Open Data to figure out like how long maintenance projects are taking on these various streets and those kinds of things. And I think for some people it's programming, for some people it's writing, for some people it's kind of, I did sort of a writing and programming combination. Some people find it through art. There are some really interesting projects out there. Folks who have made like an LED skirt and they've programmed the skirt. I've seen cool stuff like there's this really awesome project, and I'm going to remember the name of it the second I get off of this podcast. But the person effectively made a little interpreter for a programming language that allows you to create techno music, electronic music in code.
Sonny Pie.
Yes! That's it.
Yeah. From Aaron. I don't have his last name, but Aaron. I saw him at a conference in Paris doing a live performance with Sonny Pie. That was just mind-blowing. It's awesome.
It's incredible. And for somebody who's very musically inclined, writing stuff in Sonny Pie might be a great way for them to access an understanding of programming, because they don't know the code yet, but they understand how music is supposed to work. And so if they can write code that creates the kind of music that works in their understanding of the way that music works, then that might be it for them. So I think starting a blog ended up working really well for me and is an option for somebody finding a way to help themselves learn and finding a way to stay engaged in programming with an audience of themselves. But I do think there are probably other options out there. I think there are definitely other options out there, and I've seen people use them to access tech in a way that was meaningful for them.
Mm-hmm. No, and I agree with this fully. That is really the what you want to do, not the how. That is really important. And so learning in the open, consolidating what you learned, trying to rephrase it and see if you understood it, trying to teach it to somebody else. All this is the same category of how to this what consolidating for you. So right. Aim into that.
Absolutely.
When you talked about Pivotal, you said they made a mistake.
Ah, yes.
You want to talk about that?
I can, yes, I absolutely will. So Pivotal Labs at the time, now it's a little bit different now, but at the time Pivotal Labs was a consultancy that I think operated chiefly here in the United States and did immersive sort of pairing engagements with clients. Now, this was a little bit different than your typical staff augmentation consultancy job. It was an XP shop. It was an extreme programming shop. So what we would do is we would pair with client developers from the client company on a rewrite or a greenfield project that they had. And we did 100% pairing, 100% test-driven development, continuous integration, continuous deployment, just everything out of the extreme programming playbook we were doing with these clients. So we would do three to six month engagements at the beginning. Pivotal Labs had operated with a lot of success out of the West Coast. They had done things with like Square and Google and a number of clients, big and small, out on the West Coast. They then had opened a shop in Denver, and they had done a lot of Ruby on Rails projects from scratch for smaller companies in Denver. Now they were opening an office in Chicago. They did not have their own office space yet. They were working out of 1871, a co-working space, the same co-working space that the immersion program that I was in was working out of. And we happened to run into this. My instructor and I happened to run into the office director of the brand new Pivotal Labs Chicago outpost in the cafeteria area, his name, or the shared kitchen area. His name was Austin Vance. And I think on a whim, he suggested that when I graduate, I should apply to Pivotal Labs. And so I did. The interview process for Pivotal Labs involves first an RPI, Rob's Programming Interview, is what RPI stands for, named after Rob Mee, one of the original founders of Pivotal Labs. It's a 1-hour programming interview. You don't drive. The interviewer does the driving. And the idea behind that is to help you get concepts out of your head because they want to hear what you can do conceptually. It is a specific programming problem, and you get a specific score. They actually train pivots to give this interview, and they don't allow you to give it until your score is falling within a certain margin of error of everybody else's score, theoretically to create an impartial experience. And if you pass that, then the next part of the interview is a day-long interview, but you don't get specific interviews. What you do is you come in and you pair with programmers on their day-to-day work. You do that for 2 sessions in the morning. Then those 2 developers actually go to the HR person and they say whether the person should go on or not. And if the person should go on, then they take you to lunch, they bring you back, and you continue to work pairing with other programmers until 5. If it's already a wash, if we're already not going to hire the person, then we don't waste the rest of their time. And I think we still bought them lunch. I don't remember 100%, but I'm pretty sure they still got lunch and then they were sent home after lunch. So this was the process. And what may go without saying at this point was that Pivotal Labs was looking for relatively senior engineers because you needed to be able to work at a consultant level relatively quickly on these projects. Moreover, the lab's office in Chicago was just starting. So they didn't really have bandwidth to train up junior engineers. They needed people who could more or less make money for them and convince clients to keep working with them very early on. And this is where I think the mistake got made. So I did my Rob's programming interview. I believe I scored 1 point away from passing, which was not passing, but it was the highest score that Austin had ever seen a junior engineer score. He moved me on to the full day. And that was where I think Austin made the mistake, because that gave me access to all the other programmers who I could then convince that it would be great to have me on board, because I was very beginner relative to the level that they were looking for at the time. But I was very engaged in the pairing process and interested in what was going on and participating. And then after I did my day-long interview, I was not expecting to get an offer from Pivotal Labs, because I knew I was many, many, many years under what they actually needed. I knew this going in. I had been told this going in. And even after my RPI, Austin had been like, to be honest, if you want a snowball's chance in hell, you need to read these 5 books before the interview. And he literally handed me, he didn't even give me the titles. He was like, here's the physical books. He handed them to me like a librarian who's looking out for you. Was like, take these home. Please know the stuff in these by your interview, for the love of God. And so I show up, I've read my books, I'm very dutifully. Anyway, so after the interview, I wrote a blog post about everything I had learned at my interview. And I sent the URL of my blog post to the people who had interviewed me as a thank you, as sort of like a, hey, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know you took time out of your day to interview somebody who you're probably not going to accept. But it was still worth it to me. Here's what I learned. And a couple weeks later, was it a couple weeks? It was sometime later, I get a call from Austin. And he's like, so we got in a fight in your interview evaluation. Because transparently, you don't have the amount of experience that this job requires. But the engineers love you. And this one, I won't mention him by name because I suspect he really wouldn't like it. But there's one in particular who apparently made a big case. in the interview, basically. So he's like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to bring you on contract and we're going to do a contract to hire situation. Now, am I endorsing contract to hire situations? I am not. They are, in a lot of situations, exploitative. In this particular case, I understand why they did it, because probably what they should have done was reject me. And what they did instead was this contract to hire situation. And honestly, that contract to hire situation was hell on absolutely all of us. Austin's trying to grow this office from scratch. He's trying to get clients. And in the meantime, he has this like junior programmer who sort of like can't pull the weight of a senior engineer that is required in this consulting gig. So I'm like, not, you know, no matter how good I am and no matter what, I don't have the intellectual firepower to be a senior engineer when I'm a junior engineer. And like, nobody was convinced, right? Cause it's very, you can't do that. It was, I think, 7 months before I got my full-time offer at Labs. And in that 7 months, I spent a fair amount of time taking sort of like a not 100% directed study track and not quite figuring it out. And when I finally figured it out, when I finally like, I had this moment where I realized like, I'm not necessarily going to get hired here. This is going to have been an internship, you know, like these Google and Amazon internships where they bring an undergraduate or a graduate student on and they're like, okay, this person is not actually like caliber for what we need. We're going to bring them in here. They're going to have a great experience. They're going to have us on their resume as an internship and that's fine. That's what Pivotal was going to be for me if I didn't step it up, basically. Mm-hmm. And by step it up, what was meant was perform at the caliber of a senior engineer with way less experience than a senior engineer actually has. This was the point where I needed to figure out how to level myself up at a truly wild rate. And in order to do that, what I started doing was coming in the mornings before work, finding a commit where a developer on my team had done an end-to-end change on the application I was supposed to be working on, and trace that commit. And by trace that commit, I mean take a pen and a piece of paper and copy down the change set by hand in blue pen, and then go back through it and highlight anything I didn't understand and go and research it. And if I could figure it out from research, write down the answer in a different color of pen. And if I couldn't find the answer, write down my question in a red pen and then go find the most experienced engineer on my team and corner him and get those questions answered. I did this for months. I did this for months. And then in the evening, I would do all your normal, like read programming books and that kind of thing. I did this job. I was tracing commits and then I was pairing for 8 hours and then I was studying and then I was sleeping. Again, the amount of privilege required for me to be able to do this was immense. I didn't have dependents. I didn't have other things that I had going on. I did that for months. And even after I had the full-time job at Pivotal, I did that for a really long time. And I think probably if it had been any other office director, I would not have gotten that job. But Austin decided to take a chance and it was extremely emotionally heartrending for all of us. But eventually I earned my spot on the team and I stayed there for several years. I really enjoyed Pivotal Labs and I would absolutely do that kind of work again.
Which is awesome. Do you still do some a version of this exercise that you just described of finding something and really going deep into it sequentially, learning all there is to learn about this and not letting go until you really fully understand it. And then do that again and again and again.
I do. It's one of the techniques that I use. So for a while I did not use it. I started working, you know, I mean, one of the nice things about Pivotal Labs is you're typically working on greenfield code bases, which is a lot of fun for an engineer. Now, there's a whole skill set associated with working on legacy code bases that you don't learn when you're constantly working on greenfield code bases. And one of the things I think Lab started to realize in this office in Chicago, we started getting bigger clients. We were getting giant health insurance companies, giant banks, those kinds of places. And at first, they needed a greenfield mobile app. But then once they liked our work, they wanted us to help work on their legacy systems. And what we were discovering was that some of our hardline XP policies didn't work particularly well for larger, older companies. They didn't work on legacy code bases. And we were having to start to learn, if XP by the book doesn't work everywhere, in what context does it work and why? In what context doesn't it work and why? And what should we do instead? And that was a question that I do think that Pivotal Labs was kind of avoiding and was starting to contend with around the time that I left. I went to work at a product company for a little while, and then I did independent consulting for a little while. Now I work at Mozilla. And in that time, ended up working on bigger and older things and starting to answer some of these questions for myself and for my teams. Now I give workshops on working with legacy code and handling technical debt. And one of the big things that we talk about is, how do you gather context when context has been lost? I think the cause of a lot of the frustration that we experience in code bases is that there's context about how this works or why it works that has been lost because the original developer left and it wasn't sufficiently documented or something like that. So what do you do about that situation? I think first you name that situation and disambiguate it from quote unquote bad code. I think they're different. And the second thing you do is start explicitly naming and practicing and rewarding skills associated with recovering context. And I maintain that that can be programming work. I think we think of it as this like meta work that people don't want to do, but there's absolutely technical skill associated with it. And one of the skill sets within that is recovering knowledge in code bases where it is not recorded anywhere. And one of the techniques that you can use for that is take a file, take a change set, literally copy everything down. It's 2023, so I don't usually recommend that people do it by hand unless they're really hardcore, because people just won't do it. But I recommend that they use a code annotation tool created by Felina Herman, who's also just a powerhouse in programming education. Take a look at everything she writes and says. She's amazing. But she made this code annotation tool. What you do is you take a permalink from GitHub and you paste it into her tool. I'll find the URL for the show notes. And you can annotate it. You can highlight things. You can make little notes on it, those kinds of things. Or if for some reason you can't use that, you can always paste the code into a Google Doc. It's not going to work as well because the code formatting and stuff is going to be all jacked up. But you can use the comments feature on there for the same thing and effectively annotate code. And I find that that annotation procedure is extremely valuable for recovering lost context, because it turns out that code, we can take steps to make code self-documenting, to make code an artifact for its own onboarding. And that is a skill. But even in code where that hasn't been done, often the explicitness required for a program to work is still enough that if you dig, you can find clues. Code, although it is not always well documented, formats itself well for some archaeology to be done on it. And I think that that skill of archaeology is helpful. And one tactic that is helpful in that archaeology, I think, is this annotation procedure that I've described.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the alternative would be rewriting the software once, making all the same mistakes that the original people did, and then rewriting it again, this time
right.
correctly.
Right.
Yep. So you have to go through archaeology and really find context, as you were explaining. The other way around is just not practicable.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we often do to hamstring ourselves as engineers, I mean, I think the first thing we do to hamstring ourselves is we don't learn the investigative skills associated with programming outside of productivity mode. I think there's two modes. There's productivity mode, you're blasting forward on features. And then there's investigative mode. And I think investigative mode is extremely valuable when you're working in code bases that already exist. The older they are, the less well-documented they are, the more important this investigative set of skills is. And we don't teach it and we don't learn it and we don't explain to anybody how it's different from everything that they're learning in their master's program or online or from YouTube or whatever. And then in addition to the fact that we have this code base with a bunch of lost context, which is already frustrating, programmers tend to have a very underdeveloped investigative skill set relative to their productivity skill set. And that's part of the reason the debugging takes so long. It's part of the reason the getting legacy code up and running again takes so long, is that our skill set is not up to the job the way that our skill set that we have trained for building features is up to the job. So we end up in this kind of weird loop. That's a lot of what I end up doing. So I do a lot of teaching now. I teach at the University of Chicago. I teach a couple of classes for their master's program there. And I also teach workshops through O'Reilly. I teach workshops at some conferences. I'm going to be teaching one, hopefully, at DDD Europe in June, which I understand will have been over by the time this comes out. But more word on that at the time. And other conferences as well. I taught workshops last year at Strange Loop, which will be coming up in September, folks. So consider a trip to St. Louis. But a big thing that I teach about is this investigative skill set, because I think that our educational resources on how to investigate code are lacking relative to our resources on how to produce code.
Mm-hmm. I think, who was it? I won't be able to find the names. I think his company is Corgibytes. Coined the term software mender.
Software mender.
To counteract the software creation and saying, well, we're not just creating, we're mending. We seldom start with a greenfield project. Sometimes we do, but most of the time we don't. And we have to work with that. And as you said, create context and understand what's happening, and build on top of that, and not just scratch it and rewrite. And so he wanted to bring a new term in our lingua to really say, or put it in a positive way, and say, well, we're just not working with legacy projects, which kind of has a bad rep nowadays, but saying, hey, we're mending, we're fixing things so that they can be used and reused and continue their life cycle in a sustainable way, which is very nowadays problematic. And I kind of like this idea. It really stuck with me, except his name. It stuck with me, this idea of mending, and I like it. But agreed, getting context is hard, and it's not what we've been studying. We really studied how to build stuff, not how to understand, gather, do this investigation, at some point start building on top of it. That's very interesting. Thank you for that.
Right.
Where would you send people who would want to know more about this this getting context, except your workshops?
Besides my workshops.
Besides your workshop, yeah.
There are a number of resources that I like to reference in the workshops. There is a book called Working Effectively with Legacy Code called Michael Feathers. For some reason, I have 5 copies of this book. I don't understand where I got them all. But there's also a wonderful book that I have been referencing lately. It's called Living Documentation. It's by Cyril Martrere. I got this recommendation from Rebecca Werfsbrock. It was an excellent recommendation. I really like it. I do not mind headfirst design patterns, refactoring to patterns, those sorts of books. I do think it is very important to think hard about the context in which we're introducing patterns, because I do think it's easy to get pattern fever. And it is... the introduction of a pattern, I think, should begin with a consideration of the benefits and drawbacks of that pattern and whether they match the profile of constraints for this project. I really like the book Kill It With Fire, which is a book, which is a humorously named book, but it is about the maintenance and mending of software projects. I also really like the book Your Computer Is On Fire. I got that one. I follow Mar Hicks, one of the authors, on Twitter, and found out about it from there. I think that's a really good book. Highly recommend. And there is a book that I got recommended by Hillel Wayne, who does, if you've ever seen a TLA Plus workshop, it was probably by Hillel Wayne. He also does them on Alloy. These are structural verification tools for software. But he recommended me the book Understanding Software Dynamics. And he recommended me another book also called Data in the Real World. I'm a data engineer. So if you're a data engineer and you're interested in this topic, I also recommend Data in the Real World, as well as Storytelling with Data, which is by Cole Nussbaumer-Nafik. I think that's how you pronounce that. So yes, a wide library there, I would say. And then, so one that I failed to mention at the beginning is Object Design. That's by Rebecca Werfsbrock. And hold on, there's a co-author on that. Rebecca Werfsbrock and Alan McKean. So,
and that's more than 5 books already coming out.
Yeah,
of this.
I do my best. I try really hard. Well, so the thing is, I think that there are a number of books in software engineering that have kind of a cult following that I don't actually consider to be the highest quality thing for the thing that people are reading them for. And I get a lot of blowback when I say that kind of thing. So I need to be very well prepared with alternatives when people are like, oh, well, if you don't think that Clean Code is the best resource on the topic, then what do you think? And I need to be able to list like 8 and the different circumstances where they're useful, because you have to be that resourced up to question a book like that.
And you were well prepared indeed.
I try. This is how I did it at Pivotal Labs. I just needed to be able to code circles around. I have to be comically over prepared for situations.
I'm sure you're doing well on that end. That's the place where I usually ask for an advice or a piece of advice. And I want to come back to a thing you said a couple of times, to this intellectual firepower. If you had a student coming to you right now, from probably a student from your classroom in Chicago, and say, well, a teacher told me I don't have the intellectual firepower to continue on this route. What would you say?
Oh my goodness. Okay. I think I have a piece of advice for that student, and I also have a piece of advice for teachers. Yeah, and that piece of advice for teachers, I'll come back to that Peter Michael thing I kept promising y'all. The piece of advice that I would give that student, this particular, it would be such an apposite situation, because I could say, look, listen, I am teaching you in a subject in which I was told I lacked the intellectual firepower. And the truth is, this is a hot take, I think the truth is that a lot of teachers spend an insufficient amount of time building accessible pedagogy and instead build lackluster pedagogy, favor the students who do well, and usually students who do well in that circumstance probably didn't need the teacher to begin with, and then leave a lot of the students behind who actually need the accessible pedagogy that I believe it's the teacher's job to provide. And so what I would say to that student is that there are better teachers out there than whoever told you that, and that you deserve the opportunity to learn from one of them. Now, how to go about not being that teacher, I think it is easy. And I understand, believe me, all of the pressures of academia, all the pressures of capitalism and everything that make it hard for teachers to do their jobs and to want to do their jobs. But I think the answer is very much not relying on staid pedagogy and figuring and just allowing that to be what it is. I think the answer is in reinvesting and figuring out what it takes to build a classroom that is accessible for learners, because it is precisely those students who struggle to learn from standard pedagogy that need you. They are the reason that teachers are needed at all. The students who do well in the class without a lot of help didn't need the teacher. They're not the reason the teacher keeps their job. In an ideal world where education is valued the way that it should be. And I think that one of the things that I learned from the way that Peter Michael taught was that, and I didn't understand that I had learned this from him until much later, but what I learned from him was that when you build a class specifically designed to be accessible for the people who have the hardest time with this information, you're not favoring those students at the expense of students who have an easier time learning. Peter Michael took an exercise that dads do with their 4-year-olds and put it in a classroom in one of the most reputable institutions for engineering in the country, in the world. And that class loved it. More accessible resources aren't just better for the people who absolutely need them. When we design for the folks who have the hardest time accessing something, we tend to make it more accessible for everyone, including the people who would have had access to it the standard way. When we're specifically designing something for somebody who has the most trouble accessing it, it tends to get better for almost everyone. I really believe that. I think about that every time I teach, and I believe that if everybody who taught thought about that more, we would have better educational resources for everything. That's my soapbox.
Mic drop.
Yes. Chelsea, but not too hard.
Chelsea, it's been fantastic. I feel we just barely scratched the surface, but that's the show. Thank you very much for that.
Of course. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So where could people find you online and start a discussion with you about Peter Michael or anybody else or any other subject?
Yes. So my first name is Chelsea, like the neighborhood in New York, Chelsea. My last name is Troy, like Helen of Troy, Troy. And you can find my blog that I mentioned at chelseatroy.com. You can find me on Mastodon at Hey, H-E-Y, like hello, Hey Chelsea Troy. I'm on clawhammer.net, I believe is my server. I am also on Twitter currently as Hey Chelsea Troy. You can find me on Instagram also as Hey Chelsea Troy. And you can email me at chelsea@chelseatroy.com. I am regularly at conferences. You can reach out to me if you'd like me to come to a conference near you, particularly if you are a conference organizer. I'd be thrilled to receive that email so I can ask you lots of questions about the conference because I'm very excited to come to conferences. And I teach. I have a class. You can, of course, find me if you enroll in the University of Chicago or in O'Reilly. If you're an O'Reilly subscriber, I give a lot of workshops through there. Or if you just want to be able to get my stuff indie, I have a website, chelseatroy.thinkific.com. Thinkific is the provider through whom I do online courses. I have one finished online course that you can purchase there, just like you would purchase a textbook or anything else. It is called Technical Debt and Analytical Approach. That one is completed. You can also pre-order a variety of other courses I'm planning on coming out with, which will all be available in the catalog there. And you'll be able to tell they're not finished because they are pre-order rather than just purchase. Let me think. I think that might be every place online that I am regularly. But I can't wait to hear from you all online and about all of your adventures in coding and teaching.
Thank you for that. I'll do my best and add all those links to the show notes. I'll require your help for that. So you don't have to search and go back and listen to it. Everything should be there. I'll do my best about that. Chelsea, thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Of course.
And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey. And we'll see each other next week. Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for tuning in. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you like the show, please share, rate, and review. It helps more listeners discover those stories. You can find the links to all the platforms the show appears on our website, devjourney.info/subscribe. Creating the show every week takes a lot of time, energy, and of course money. Would you please help me continue bringing out those inspiring stories every week by pledging a small monthly donation? You'll find our Patreon link at devjourney.info/donate. And finally, don't hesitate to reach out and tell me how this week's story is shaping your future. You can find me on Twitter. I am at Timothep, T-I-M-O-T-H-E-P, or per email, info@devjourney.info. Talk to you soon.